Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and I'm joined now by novelist Mohsen Hamid, whose new novel is getting some great reviews. One review I saw likened it to The Great Gatsby, called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. It borrows some of its structure from the self-help genre while telling a love story in an unnamed Asian country that seems a lot like Pakistan, by the way, where Mohsen lives. And welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Are there actual self-help books with the titles like that of your novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia?
I mean, I think there are self-help books. If you walk into a bookshop in Pakistan or really anywhere in Asia, you tend to face this whole shelf of self-help books on everything from how to be a good lover to have a good job and build a good spreadsheet.
And maybe you can read a little to help give the listeners an idea. I know you picked out a little section that you'll read for us. And I guess this is a paragraph about the limits of self-help when it comes to getting rich from the chapter called Get an Education.
Yes, that's right. Getting an education is a running leap towards becoming filthy rich in rising Asia. This is no secret. But like many desirable things, simply being well known does not make it easily achieved. There are forks in the road to wealth that have nothing to do with choice or desire or effort. Forks that have to do with chance. And in your case, the order of your birth is one of these. Third means you are not heading back to the village. Third means you are not working as a painter's assistant. Third also means that you are not, like the fourth of you three surviving siblings, a tiny skeleton in a small grave at the base of a tree.
Wow, that's a haunting passage. And it's actually kind of the opposite of self-help, at least that little bit, because it's pretty fatalistic, those sentences.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of fatalism in it. It's really about, you know, the existence in the new Asian megacities. People are moving to these cities from the countryside, and it's tough. So there is a lot of fatalism, a lot of things outside of your control. But at the same time, you do have many people, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people entering the middle class and moving up. So it's a combination of fatalism and perhaps having some agency yourself.
No one gets named in the novel, speaking of having agency. It's all written in the second person, I saw. So the main character is just referred to as you, as in that passage. His love interest is the pretty girl, and the country where the novel is set is only identified as part of Rising Asia. What appealed to you about that lack of specificity?
Well, a few different things. One was I was trying to talk about Pakistan initially without being overly influenced by how everybody else has spoken about Pakistan. You know, Pakistan's become a kind of shorthand for violence. Islam has certain connotations, even names like Osama or Ali or Omar have connotations now. So I thought if I was used a sort of a nameless form, I could strip away those connotations. But when I began to do it, I realized another thing was starting to happen, which was that instead of writing about a particular, peculiar place, things began to feel more universal. You know, mother reminds me as a reader of my mother and isn't just this character's mother. So it became a way to allow the reader to be a kind of character in the book.
You grew up in Pakistan and then came here to be educated at Princeton and Harvard. So how much is this your story?
Well, I think, you know, I am a lifelong migrant. I came to America as a child and spent 6 years in California, went back to Pakistan, came back to study here, went back to Pakistan where I live now. I've continuously moved. And so this enormous movement of people from small villages to the big city, this kind of mass migration of billions of people, does feel to have echoes to me of my own story.
You and F. Scott Fitzgerald maybe have more in common than novels about a man's rise to great heights in pursuit of a pretty woman and the society that surrounds them. You both did go to Princeton.
We both went to Princeton. I read, of course, The Great Gatsby in school and many times since, and you know, obviously I'm a huge admirer. But one other thing which I have learned from and respect a great deal about, particularly Gatsby, is how, you know, Fitzgerald was able to write an enormous novel in very few pages. That sort of compression that he achieves is something that, to me, is really appealing.
And you do it, too. This book is a very easy read. It's not overly long, and yet There are so many ideas in it. It is so rich with culture. And really, it goes over the entire life cycle of the main two characters.
That's right. You know, growing up in Pakistan, most of my friends didn't read literary fiction. And so I wanted to write fiction that was sort of uncompromising in terms of, you know, what it was trying to do and the complexity it was willing to take on, but that wouldn't repel, you know, non-literary fiction readers. I didn't want to be inside some kind of self-referential literary ghetto. And I wanted my cousins to read it. So for that, you know, writing a compressed novel and hopefully writing a novel that, you know, is a yarn that spins a tale was important.
And my guest spinning that yarn is novelist Mohsin Hamid. Maybe you knew his last book, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which is now being made into a film directed by Meir Nair, by the way. And if anybody wants to call in, maybe this sounds like you. Are there any other Pakistani Americans here who say, oh, I get this, or Chinese Americans for that matter, or anybody who relates to this idea of how to get filthy rich in Rising Asia, the satirical title of the novel? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Give us a call. What do you think a young person in Rising Asia seeking to get filthy rich, and I know there are plenty of them, would think of your novel?
Well, you know, one thing I've discovered is that we just can't generalize about readers. I once met this blonde guy with dreadlocks and lugs in his ears and a pierced eyebrow, and he came to me after reading of Reluctant Fundamentalist in Washington, D.C., and said, dude, this book is about me. And I was thinking, you know, this is a book about a Pakistani guy who grows a beard, moves back to Pakistan, leaves New York City. And so I was baffled. I said, you know, why? He said, well, because I also went to an Ivy League school. I also worked at this, you know, Wall Street job, and I dropped out to become a yoga instructor. And the amazing thing, if you travel around with a book, is just how different people's reactions are all over the place. So you can't really generalize. But that said, a lot of young people in I think Asia are facing this real kind of up or out society where if you're poor, it is crushing. And the incentives to try to get somewhat richer are strong.
It reminds me of a friend of mine who was tired of all the Western rat race, became an ardent meditator, sort of dropped out, wanted to go spend time in India to get back to some traditional reality. And when he got to India, he discovered that the students there were protesting to modernize.
That's right. I think, you know, there's an enormous flip that's gone on. The American dream perhaps is more alive in Asian cities today than anywhere else in the world, or at least the idea of the American dream, people wanting to pull themselves up.
Do you think Asia has a lot in common with the America of Fitzgerald's time? Not to make too much of those analogies, but the urbanization and the no-holds-barred brand of capitalism, the high contrast of those living on the ash heaps with those in mansions?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at a photograph of New York around the time that the Empire State Building was being built, and all of those workers are pretty gaunt. You know, they've got hollow cheeks, they look really skinny. You've got to believe there wasn't that much food going around. Life was tough. And I think as the Asian cities and the Asian urbanization goes forward, as the Asian economic boom goes forward, it is in some ways like the 1920s in America. And in a sense, our world is becoming more similar as that takes place. And it's also creating another thing, which is a kind of, you could say, spiritual or if you're not a spiritual person, mental health crisis, as people are anxious and depressed in the face of this rapidly changing new reality.
So after leaving school, your protagonist becomes a, quote, non-expired labeled expired goods salesman, and then becomes a bottled water producer, first by boiling his own tap water and eventually becoming what the book calls a filthy rich industrialist, selling bottled water as the water system is breaking down in his home city. Is that just the other side of legal to established, you know, a typical track?
I think so. I mean, you know, a lot of market niches out there, a lot of the big profits to be made are just on the other side of what's legal. And we've seen that in, you know, Wall Street in the last decade. We've seen it in so many different businesses over time. And so, you know, this young man figures out that if he sells expired goods but erases the expiry date and sells them as new goods but sells them cheaper, or sells bottled water that's fake bottled water, there's a market for these things. And so if you go, you know, to Asia today, there's a huge amount of fakes and there's a huge amount of piracy and a huge amount of law bending going on in the entrepreneurial sector.
There's a lovely passage toward the end where the narrator gives us some commentary on why we tell and read stories and the role that empathy plays. It's one of the more earnest parts of the book. Can you comment on it?
Well, you know, the book, I think, moves towards earnestness as it progresses. So it starts off as perhaps a semi-joke on the whole idea of getting filthy rich. But what emerges is, as you have this narrative of growth, of the market, of getting more money, more wealth, the other side of human existence, which is the narrative of loss, getting older, losing your loved ones, losing your life eventually, mortality, which is ignored, gets stronger and stronger and stronger and demands a response. So I think by the end of the novel, I am trying to somewhat earnestly address the way in which novels are self-help for me as a novel writer and possibly even self-help for readers.
Put your headphones on. I want to get one call in for you, and I think this is a Pakistani immigrant, Hussein in Queens. Hussein, you're on the air. Hi.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brian. Mr. Hamid, I have one question that you ever considered about the Cummings. They were those brother and sisters who were working for centuries for the landlords. And at the end of the crops, for example, rice or wheat, they will get some money. So after the partition or after the independence, this middle class, they become professional. They become they were free of this landlord class. And they start by if they were carpenters, they start making these things. Barbers, they went to Middle East, and they make a lot of money. And at this moment, if you see that a person who is in Middle East, even as a barber or as a laborer, he's making more money than a major or than a general.
I think that's right. You know, the novel starts with that position. Somebody who works, as you say, like a sharecropper, you know, in a Pakistani rural context where there's landlords who own the land and life is very, very tough. And the main character of the novel is one of these people who leaves and pursues a kind of more entrepreneurial life. The one thing you identified, which was that, you know, people used to have to leave Pakistan to find that kind of those kind of opportunities. More and more, I think people are also leaving the countryside and moving to the city. That migration inside Pakistan is almost like what an international migration used to be, because in a big city like Karachi or Lahore, you now have new economies and new opportunities. Obviously, things are still deeply, deeply problematic in Pakistan.
And you might wind up in a shanty town, but
absolutely,
you might wind up your family progressing beyond your wildest dreams.
Absolutely. So I think the point you've made is exactly right, that what used to be an international migration has now also become kind of a intranational migration to the cities.
Here's a fan, Yenepti in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I was first introduced to Motion with the Third Born article that he wrote in The New York, and I just want him to talk about that because it was a beautifully written article.
Well, that
story,
yeah,
short story.
That story was excerpted from the novel, and it took the first two chapters of the novel, but stripped away the self-help book frame. So The New Yorker doesn't tend to excerpt novels. They prefer to go with just short stories. So recrafting the first two chapters into a short story was what you read in that. But again, yes, that was the same basic piece of fiction as the novel.
We're going to mention that Motion has a reading tonight at Greenlight Books in Fort Greene. We have more information on our website. But I also saw that last night you were in conversation with Suketu Mehta, Mumbai to New York transplant, one of our favorite guests on the show. Maybe the two of you would be able to solve all the problems on the subcontinent if just left to yourselves.
Well, Suketu's a dear buddy. You know, when he came and stayed with me and my family in Lahore some years ago, my mother decided, because he's a vegetarian, that our whole house would go vegetarian for a week. And Suketu, of course, thoroughly enjoyed the vegetarian options that he was presented with. But we later benefited from the fact that in the course of a week, we wound up rediscovering so many Punjabi vegetarian dishes. So it's been a fantastic experience for both of us, that encounter.
And we will have to leave it there. I've so enjoyed this, speaking to Mohsin Hamid about his new novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And again, he will be reading from the novel tonight at 7:30 at the Greenlight Bookstore in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.